3. The theory of Protagoras is connected by Aristotle as well as Plato with the flux of Heraclitus. But Aristotle is only following Plato, and Plato, as we have already seen, did not mean to imply that such a connection was admitted by Protagoras himself. His metaphysical genius saw or seemed to see a common tendency in them, just as the modern historian of ancient philosophy might perceive a parallelism between two thinkers, of which they were probably unconscious themselves. We must remember throughout that Plato is not speaking of Heraclitus, but of the Heraclitians, who succeeded him, nor of the great original ideas of the master, but of the Aristic into which they had degenerated 100 years later. There is nothing in the fragments of Heraclitus which at all justifies Plato's account of him. His philosophy may be resolved into two elements: first, change; secondly, law or measure pervading the change. These he saw everywhere, and often expressed in strange mythological symbols. But he has no analysis of sensible perception such as Plato attributes to him, nor is there any reason to suppose that he pushed his philosophy into that absolute negation in which Heraclitianism was sunk in the age of Plato. He never said that change means every sort of change, and he expressly distinguished between the general and particular understanding. Like a poet, he surveyed the elements of mythology, nature, thought, which lay before him, and sometimes by the light of genius he saw, or seemed to see, a mysterious principle working behind them. But as has been the case with other great philosophers, and with Plato and Aristotle themselves, what was really permanent and original could not be understood by the next generation, while a perverted logic carried out his chance expressions with an illogical consistency. His simple and noble thoughts, like those of the great Eleatic, soon degenerated into a mere strife of words. And when thus reduced to mere words, they seem to have exercised a far wider influence in the cities of Ionia, where the people were mad about them, than in the lifetime of Heraclitus, a phenomenon which, though at first sight singular, is not without a parallel in the history of philosophy and theology. It is this perverted form of the Heraclitian philosophy which is supposed to affect the final overthrow of Protagorean sensationalism. For if all things are changing at every moment, in all sorts of ways, then there is nothing fixed or defined at all, and therefore no sensible perception, nor any true word by which that, or anything else, can be described. Of course Protagoras would not have admitted the justice of this argument any more than Heraclitus would have acknowledged the uneducated fanatics who appealed to his writings. He might have said, "The excellent Socrates has first confused me with Heraclitus, and Heraclitus with his Ephesian successors, and has then disproved the existence both of knowledge and sensation. But I am not responsible for what I never said, nor will I admit that my common sense account of knowledge can be overthrown by unintelligible Heraclitian paradoxes." IV. Still at the bottom of the arguments there remains a truth, that knowledge is something more than sensible perception. This alone would not distinguish man from a tadpole. The absoluteness of sensations at each moment destroys the very consciousness of sensations, or the power of comparing them. The senses are not mere holes in a Trojan horse, but the organs of a presiding nature, in which they meet. A great advance has been made in psychology, when the senses are recognized as organs of sense, and we are admitted to see, or feel through them, and not by them, a distinction of words which, as Socrates observes, is by no means pedantic. A still further step has been made, when the most abstract notions, such as being and not being, sameness and difference, unity and plurality, are acknowledged to be the creations of the mind herself, working upon the feelings or impressions of sense. In this manner Plato describes the process of acquiring them, in the words, "Knowledge consists not in the feelings or affections, re it is, but in the process of reasoning about them." Here, as in the Parmenides, he means something not really different from generalization. As in the Sophist, he is laying the foundation of a rational psychology, which is to supersede the Platonic reminiscence of ideas as well as the Eleatic being, and the individualism of Megarians and cynics. V. Having rejected the doctrine that knowledge is perception, we now proceed to look for a definition of knowledge in the sphere of opinion. But here we are met by a singular difficulty: how is false opinion possible? For we must either know or not know that which is presented to the mind or to sense. We of course should answer at once no. The alternative is not necessary, for there may be degrees of knowledge, and we may know and have forgotten, or we may be learning, or we may have a general, but not a particular knowledge, or we may know, but not be able to explain, and many other ways may be imagined in which we know and do not know at the same time. But these answers belong to a later stage of metaphysical discussion, whereas the difficulty in question naturally arises owing to the childhood of the human mind, like the parallel difficulty respecting not being. Men had only recently arrived at the notion of opinion; they could not at once define the true, and pass beyond into the false. The very word was full of ambiguity, being sometimes, as in the Eleatic philosophy, applied to the sensible world, and again used in the more ordinary sense of opinion. There is no connection between sensible appearance and probability, and yet both of them met in the word, and could hardly be disengaged from one another in the mind of the Greek living in the 5th or 4th century BC. To this was often added, as at the end of the 5th book of the Republic, the idea of relation, which is equally distinct from either of them. Also a fourth notion, the conclusion of the dialectical process, the making up of the mind, after she has been talking to herself. We are not then surprised that the sphere of opinion, and of not being, should be a dusky, half-lighted place, belonging neither to the old world of sense and imagination, nor to the new world of reflection and reason. Plato attempts to clear up this darkness. In his accustomed manner he passes from the lower to the higher, without omitting the intermediate stages. This appears to be the reason why he seeks for the definition of knowledge first in the sphere of opinion. Hereafter we shall find that something more than opinion is required. False opinion is explained by Plato at first as a confusion of mind and sense, which arises when the impression on the mind does not correspond to the impression made on the senses. It is obvious that this explanation, supposing the distinction between impressions on the mind and impressions on the senses to be admitted, does not account for all forms of error, and Plato has excluded himself from the consideration of the greater number by designedly omitting the intermediate processes of learning and forgetting, nor does he include fallacies in the use of language or erroneous inferences. But he is struck by one possibility of error, which is not covered by his theory, viz. Errors in arithmetic. For in numbers and calculation there is no combination of thought and sense, and yet errors may often happen. Hence he is led to discard the explanation which might nevertheless have been supposed to hold good for anything which he says to the contrary, as a rationale of error, in the case of facts derived from sense. Another attempt is made to explain false opinion by assigning to error a sort of positive existence. But error or ignorance is essentially negative, a not knowing. If we knew an error, we should be no longer in error. We may veil our difficulty under figures of speech, but these, although telling arguments with the multitude, can never be the real foundation of a system of psychology. Only they lead us to dwell upon mental phenomena which, if expressed in an abstract form, would not be realized by us at all. The figure of the mind receiving impressions is one of those images which have rooted themselves forever in language. It may or may not be a gracious aid to thought, but it cannot be got rid of. The other figure of the enclosure is also remarkable as affording the first hint of universal all-pervading ideas, a notion further carried out in the sophist. This is implied in the birds, some in flocks, some solitary, which fly about anywhere and everywhere. Plato discards both figures, as not really solving the question which to us appears so simple: how do we make mistakes? The failure of the inquiry seems to show that we should return to knowledge, and begin with that, and we may afterwards proceed, with a better hope of success, to the examination of opinion. but is true opinion really distinct from knowledge? The difference between these he seeks to establish by an argument, which to us appears singular and unsatisfactory. The existence of true opinion is proved by the rhetoric of the law courts, which cannot give knowledge, but may give true opinion. The rhetorician cannot put the judge or juror in possession of all the facts which prove an act of violence, but he may truly persuade them of the commission of such an act. Here the idea of true opinion seems to be a right conclusion from imperfect knowledge. But the correctness of such an opinion will be purely accidental, and is really the effect of one man, who has the means of knowing, persuading another who has not. Plato would have done better if he had said that true opinion was a contradiction in terms. Assuming the distinction between knowledge and opinion, Theaetetus, in answer to Socrates, proceeds to define knowledge as true opinion, with definite or rational explanation. This Socrates identifies with another and different theory of those who assert that knowledge first begins with a proposition. The elements may be perceived by sense, but they are names, and cannot be defined. When we assign to them some predicate, they first begin to have a meaning. This seems equivalent to saying that the individuals of sense become the subject of knowledge when they are regarded as they are in nature in relation to other individuals. Yet we feel a difficulty in following this new hypothesis. For must not opinion be equally expressed in a proposition? The difference between true and false opinion is not the difference between the particular and the universal, but between the true universal and the false. Thought may be as much at fault as sight. When we place individuals under a class, or assign to them attributes, this is not knowledge, but a very rudimentary process of thought, the first generalization of all, without which language would be impossible. And has Plato kept altogether clear of a confusion, which the analogous word tends to create, of a proposition and a definition? And is not the confusion increased by the use of the analogous term elements, or letters? For there is no real resemblance between the relation of letters to a syllable, and of the terms to a proposition. Plato, in the spirit of the Megarian philosophy, soon discovers a flaw in the explanation. For how can we know a compound, of which the simple elements are unknown to us? Can two unknowns make a known? Can a whole be something different from the parts? The answer of experience is that they can, for we may know a compound, which we are unable to analyze into its elements, and all the parts, when united, may be more than all the parts separated, e.g. the number 4, or any other number, is more than the units which are contained in it. Any chemical compound is more than, and different from the simple elements. But ancient philosophy in this, as in many other instances, proceeding by the path of mental analysis, was perplexed by doubts which warred against the plainest facts. Three attempts to explain the new definition of knowledge still remain to be considered. They all of them turn on the explanation of, the first account of the meaning of the word, is the reflection of thought in speech, a sort of nominalism. La science est une langue bien faite. But anybody who is not dumb can say what he thinks, therefore mere speech cannot be knowledge. And yet we may observe that there is in this explanation an element of truth which is not recognized by Plato, viz. That truth and thought are inseparable from language, although mere expression in words is not truth. The second explanation of, is the enumeration of the elementary parts of the complex whole. But this is only definition accompanied with right opinion, and does not yet attain to the certainty of knowledge. Plato does not mention the greater objection, which is, that the enumeration of particulars is endless. Such a definition would be based on no principle, and would not help us at all in gaining a common idea. The third is the best explanation, the possession of a characteristic mark, which seems to answer to the logical definition by genus and difference. But this, again, is equally necessary for right opinion, and we have already determined, although not on very satisfactory grounds, that knowledge must be distinguished from opinion. A better distinction is drawn between them in the Timaeus. They might be opposed as philosophy and rhetoric, and as conversant respectively with necessary and contingent matter, but no true idea of the nature of either of them, or of their relation to one another, could be framed until science obtained a content. The ancient philosophers in the age of Plato thought of science only as pure abstraction, and to this opinion stood in no relation. Like Theaetetus, we have attained to no definite result. But an interesting phase of ancient philosophy has passed before us. And the negative result is not to be despised. For on certain subjects, and in certain states of knowledge, the work of negation, or clearing the ground must go on, perhaps for a generation, before the new structure can begin to rise. Plato saw the necessity of combating the illogical logic of the Megarians and Aristics. For the completion of the edifice, he makes preparation in the Theaetetus, and crowns the work in the Sophist. Many, 1, fine expressions, and, 2, remarks full of wisdom, 3, also germs of a metaphysic of the future, are scattered up and down in the dialogue. Such, for example, as, 1, the comparison of Theaetetus' progress in learning to the noiseless flow of a river of oil, the satirical touch, flavoring a sauce or fawning speech, or the remarkable expression, full of impure dialectic, or the lively images under which the argument is described, the flood of arguments pouring in, the fresh discussions bursting in like a band of revelers. 2. As illustrations of the second head, may be cited the remark of Socrates, that distinctions of words, although sometimes pedantic, are also necessary, or the fine touch in the character of the lawyer, that dangers came upon him, when the tenderness of youth was unequal to them, or the description of the manner in which the spirit is broken in a wicked man who listens to reproof until he becomes like a child, or the punishment of the wicked, which is not physical suffering, but the perpetual companionship of evil, or the saying, often repeated by Aristotle and others, that philosophy begins in wonder, for Iris is the child of Thormes, or the superb contempt with which the philosopher takes down the pride of wealthy landed proprietors by comparison of the whole earth. 3. Important metaphysical ideas are, a. the conception of thought, as the mind talking to herself, b. the notion of a common sense, developed further by Aristotle, and the explicit declaration, that the mind gains her conceptions of being, sameness, number, and the like, from reflection on herself. See the excellent distinction of Theaetetus, which Socrates, speaking with emphasis, leaves to grow, between seeing the forms or hearing the sounds of words in a foreign language, and understanding the meaning of them, and d. the distinction of Socrates himself between the having and possessing knowledge, in which the answer to the whole discussion appears to be contained. There is a difference between ancient and modern psychology, and we have a difficulty in explaining one in the terms of the other. To us the inward and outward sense and the inward and outward worlds of which they are the organs are parted by a wall, and appear as if they could never be confounded. The mind is endued with faculties, habits, instincts, and a personality or consciousness in which they are bound together. Over against these are placed forms, colors, external bodies coming into contact with our own body. We speak of a subject which is ourselves, of an object which is all the rest. These are separable in thought, but united in any act of sensation, reflection, or volition. As there are various degrees in which the mind may enter into, or be abstracted from the operations of sense, so there are various points at which this separation or union may be supposed to occur. And within the sphere of mind the analogy of sense reappears. And we distinguish, not only external objects, but objects of will, and of knowledge which we contrast with them. These again are comprehended in a higher object, which reunites with the subject. A multitude of abstractions are created by the efforts of successive thinkers which become logical determinations, and they have to be arranged in order, before the scheme of thought is complete. The framework of the human intellect is not the peculium of an individual, but the joint work of many who are of all ages and countries. What we are in mind is due, not merely to our physical, but to our mental antecedents which we trace in history, and more especially in the history of philosophy. nor can mental phenomena be truly explained either by physiology or by the observation of consciousness apart from their history. They have a growth of their own, like the growth of a flower, a tree, a human being. They may be conceived as of themselves constituting a common mind, and having a sort of personal identity in which they coexist. So comprehensive is modern psychology, seeming to aim at constructing anew the entire world of thought. And prior to or simultaneously with this construction, a negative process has to be carried on, a clearing away of useless abstractions which we have inherited from the past. Many erroneous conceptions of the mind derived from former philosophies have found their way into language, and we with difficulty disengage ourselves from them. Mere figures of speech have unconsciously influenced the minds of great thinkers. Also, there are some distinctions, as, for example, that of the will, and of the reason, and of the moral and intellectual faculties, which are carried further than is justified by experience. Any separation of things which we cannot see or exactly define, though it may be necessary, is a fertile source of error. The division of the mind into faculties or powers or virtues is too deeply rooted in language to be got rid of, but it gives a false impression. For if we reflect on ourselves, we see that all our faculties easily pass into one another and are bound together in a single mind or consciousness. But this mental unity is apt to be concealed from us by the distinctions of language. A profusion of words and ideas has obscured, rather than enlightened, mental science. It is hard to say how many fallacies have arisen from the representation of the mind as a box, as a tabula rasa, a book, a mirror, and the like. It is remarkable how Plato in the Theaetetus, after having indulged in the figure of the waxen doublet and the decoy, afterwards discards them. The mind is also represented by another class of images, as the spring of a watch, a motive power, a breath, a stream, a succession of points or moments. As Plato remarks in the Cratylus, words expressive of motion as well as of rest are employed to describe the faculties and operations of the mind. And in these there is contained another store of fallacies. Some shadow or reflection of the body seems always to adhere to our thoughts about ourselves, and mental processes are hardly distinguished in language from bodily ones. To see or perceive are used indifferently of both, the words intuition, moral sense, common sense, the mind's eye, are figures of speech transferred from one to the other. And many other words used in early poetry, or in sacred writings, to express the works of mind have a materialistic sound, for old mythology was allied to sense, and the distinction of matter and mind had not as yet arisen. This materialism receives an alias of aid from language, and both in philosophy and religion the imaginary figure or association easily takes the place of real knowledge. Again, there is the illusion of looking into our own minds, as if our thoughts or feelings were written down in a book. This is another figure of speech, which might be appropriately termed the fallacy of the looking glass. We cannot look at the mind, unless we have the eye which sees, and we can only look, not into, but out of the mind at the thoughts, words, actions of ourselves and others. What we dimly recognize within us is not experience, but rather the suggestion of an experience, which we may gather, if we will, from the observation of the world. The memory has but a feeble recollection of what we were saying, or doing a few weeks or a few months ago, and still less of what we were thinking or feeling. This is one among many reasons why there is so little self-knowledge among mankind. They do not carry with them the thought of what they are or have been. The so-called facts of consciousness are equally evanescent. They are facts which nobody ever saw, and which can neither be defined nor described. Of the three laws of thought, the first, all A equals A, is an identical proposition, that is to say, a mere word or symbol claiming to be a proposition. The two others, nothing can be A and not A, and everything is either A or not A, are untrue, because they exclude degrees, and also the mixed modes and double aspects under which truth is so often presented to us. To assert that man is unmeaning, to say that he is free or necessary, and cannot be both is a half-truth only. These are a few of the entanglements which impede the natural course of human thought. Lastly, there is the fallacy which lies still deeper, of regarding the individual mind apart from the universal, or either, as a self-existent entity apart from the ideas which are contained in them.